Vice President Joe Biden just ended speculation. He will not seek the Democratic nomination for president. What does this mean for the Democratic race? Politics Day on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donna Hoffman and Stefan Schmidt on board today to analyze the Biden announcement and other recent political developments, including Paul Ryan's conditions to become Speaker of the House. Partisan warfare erupts on the House Select Committee on Benghazi as Hillary Clinton gets set to testify tomorrow. And we'll hear from John Dillon of Vermont Public Radio to get a long view of Bernie Sanders. He's covered Sanders for more than 25 years. Join our discussion. First, this news. Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Stefan Schmidt, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Stefan, great to have you on board.
Nice to join you.
Donna Hoffman with us as well in our Cedar Falls studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Donna, welcome to you.
Well, I'm glad to be here with you and Stefan.
A jam-packed week. Lots of things to analyze this hour. We'll get right to it because we had just moments ago another item added to the list. Vice President Joe Biden just ended speculation. He will not seek the Democratic nomination for president. Biden made these comments at a press conference in the Rose Garden just about an hour ago.
Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination. But while I will not be a candidate, I will not be silent. I intend to speak out clearly and forcefully to influence as much as I can where we stand as a party and where we need to go as a nation.
Joe Biden just moments ago. River to River listeners, are you a Biden backer? Are you disappointed that he will not be in the race? Join us with your comments, your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or respond on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Donna Hoffman, what does this mean for the Democratic race?
Well, it gels a little bit because there had been almost this endless speculation that Biden would get in, that he wouldn't get in. That then again, there was more speculation earlier in the week that maybe there were signs that he was seriously going to do it. And so it puts that to rest and brings the field into a bit more focus. And, you know, Jim Webb dropped out this week, as we'll talk about probably later. But, you know, it ends the speculation of will he or won't he. And, you know, that takes us further down the field.
Stefan, where is Biden's support likely to go?
Well, I mean, the wonderful thing for Hillary Clinton is that Biden dropping out frees up all of the big donors who had been holding back on their checkbooks to see how this would all work its way out. I mean, they probably some of them would have gone with Biden. Others would have written checks for Hillary, but they were waiting. And now that he's out, I think checks are going to start flowing. And a lot of those checks are going to go to Hillary Clinton. And I also think that probably many of the 15% or so who were saying that they like Biden probably are going to go to Hillary Clinton because, well, I think they're more mainstream.
Okay, so her policies, her vision of our future as a nation lines up more with President Biden than it does with, say, Bernie Sanders?
Well, some of her policies, because Biden has also been a kind of a thorn in Hillary Clinton's side, you know, criticizing some things and talking, especially the latest eruption of this, you know, who was in favor and who was not in favor of going after Osama bin Laden. So, you know, that there are some things in which they disagree. But I think that the statement that he made here in how he pulled out is also a little bit alarming. And I think Hillary Clinton is probably somewhat worried, maybe Sanders as well, because he has threatened or promised to intervene in moving the Democratic Party in a direction that he thinks is constructive. And I think that speaks mostly to Hillary Clinton saying that the Republicans are the enemy, because he came out very strongly in several speeches saying, no, you know, we can't, they're not the enemy. You can't do that. We have to sit down and talk with them and so on. So I think there's going to be some friction, even though he is not in the race.
Right. Widely seen as a gaffe by Hillary Clinton. The last question of the final of the last week's Democratic debate, when I guess all of the candidates were asked to name a
An enemy. Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton named a few real enemies that we have in the world, and then she kind of laughed, I guess, and said Republicans.
Well, she put the Republicans in with Iran. So, you know, that's pretty serious business.
Donna, you mentioned Jim Webb yesterday, the former U.S. senator, is also a dropout. His long shot bid for the 2016 Democratic presidential nomination. He now says he'll explore an independent run for the White House. Webb didn't really connect with today's Democratic voters. He wasn't polling well. I suppose there aren't too many implications of a possible independent run. Why isn't he connecting?
Well, you know, he doesn't fit very well within the Republican Party, or at least the primary electorate of the Democratic Party, excuse me. You know, he used to be a Republican. He was in Reagan's administration. He really was and positioned himself as kind of being centrist. And even in his speech in which he dropped out, he basically said, you know, I'm not fitting very well with the current primary electorate, and so I'm stepping out of it. But I'll still, you know, explore an independent run. So I think he didn't resonate in many ways, just because he was really looking to appeal to a particular type of the Democratic electorate, which was really disaffected white-collar workers. And they've, you know, had a precarious position in our electoral system for a period of time. And for whatever reason, he just didn't resonate. He wasn't getting a lot of attention, you know, in that first debate. He even complained during the debate about the lack of attention that he was getting at the debate.
And right. So, and that was made much fun of on
and it was
comedy skits.
And it was. And he, you know, so he, you know, made the decision to drop out and potentially will explore an independent bid. So I think that will be interesting to see if he goes forward with that and if he feels like he can really connect with those voters that he's seeking to connect to, and if they really determine there's enough of those voters to make it worth going forward for him.
Donna Hoffman with us at the University of Northern Iowa. Stefan Schmidt, our other political analyst on board this week on Politics Wednesday of Iowa State University. Let's turn, we'll probably return to it, I'm sure we will, presidential politics. But let's go over to happenings in the House, U.S. House Republicans. Of course, this turmoil since John Boehner announced last month he wanted to retire. This coming after years of battling the right wing in his party. Yesterday, a reluctant U.S. Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin laid out a series of conditions under which he would seek to become Speaker of the House of Representatives. Ryan said he will only serve if fractious Republicans unite behind him to replace retiring Speaker Boehner. He listed requirements. Republicans will stop being an opposition party. Republicans will need to update House rules so everyone can be more effective and a more effective representative. The conference needs to unify now, and Ryan cannot and will not give up time with his family. Most importantly, he said he will not run unless all wings of the party support him.
What I told members is, if you can agree to these requests, and if I can truly be a unifying figure, then I will gladly serve. And if I'm not unifying, that will be fine as well. I'll be happy to stay where I am at the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, we expect to have our answer by the end of the week, I suppose. Stefan Schmidt, do you see Ryan as the next Speaker of the House? Will these conditions be met by the right wing in the party?
Well, it's, you know, if I knew that question, I would be, you know, retiring with a large check because, in fact, there are still great concerns among very conservative Republicans and others. The Drudge report this morning had some pretty nasty things to say about Ryan. He's considered to be not conservative enough. Some even call him a rhino, a Republican in name only. And so it's hard to tell if the Freedom Caucus, so-called, will yield and give up what they want as leverage, because if they do, they will have lost. I mean, they simply will have lost. And Ryan is right not to concede, because what the Freedom Caucus wants to do is basically change really the process to, pardon the expression, castrate the Speaker of the House and defang him, two different metaphors there. And I think he's not going to put up with that because he's not going to take a job where he's just a ping pong ball to be, you know, bounced back and forth between establishment Republicans and conservatives. So I don't think the deal is done.
Okay. Your view on it, Donna Hoffman?
I think Stefan's right. I don't think it's done yet either. After Ryan made his appearance yesterday, several of the members of the Freedom Caucus, as it is called, said they're still sticking with Daniel Webster, who they had earlier backed in that regard. And so I don't think Ryan put to rest that he satisfied those factions that he was talking about. And, you know, quite frankly, I think Ryan really would be happiest as staying chair of Ways and Means. That's really where his heart lies. He wants to do significant policy changes, especially in regards to tax policy, and would particularly like to do that under a Republican president. And if he's speaker, he's, you know, speaker of a very fractious caucus. One of the things in terms of the rule changes of his conditions that he made was, you know, that they would have to quit using this vacate the chair motion, which is what has bedeviled Boehner a couple of times. And, you know, that's not something that the Freedom Caucus wants to do, because that is one of the things that has given them leverage. And so I don't know how it's going to turn out. But
what possible,
I'm not sure.
What possible scenarios if they cannot come to an agreement and Ryan says, no, thank you, I'll stay. I'm very happy to stay where I am right now in Ways and Means. What happens? Is it just a void out there, or can you paint a possible scenario for us?
I think there is a void out there. And, you know, Daniel Webster is the person who the Freedom Caucus had previously said they would back. He is not very well known. His district in Florida even got just, you know, is going to change because of the redistricting lawsuit. And so he may not even be in the next Congress. And so it's not clear to anyone, you know, and interesting about some of the comments that Ryan made the other day. He said he was going to make himself available basically because he saw it as a, quote, dire moment. That's a quote. That's what he said, a dire moment. And if they don't go with him, I'm not sure what they do.
No, there is one scenario, which is probably not that likely, but that is essentially a bipartisan speaker in which, you know, the Republicans get together with Democrats and pick someone that is amenable to establishment Republicans and to a large chunk of Democrats. And that is, you know, and if that were to happen, that would be a horrible blow to the Republican caucus and to the
Really? In these hyper-partisan times, you think that's possible, bringing together the middle under one speaker?
No, I don't think it's possible, but it's been discussed as one of the options. You can't do without a speaker. It's a constitutional position. It's third in line to the presidency. Without it, Congress, the House, cannot operate. It's like having the Des Moines Symphony Orchestra try to perform without their conductor.
Another scenario you could have, too, is that someone from who's not currently in the House comes in and is tapped to be Speaker. Newt Gingrich the other day helpfully put himself forward, you know, to do that. But, you know, it is true that you don't technically have to be a member of the House to be Speaker of the House. And while I think that's a very rare scenario as well, but it's something that has been bandied about.
Well,
as,
Mitt
as
Romney's
a possibility.
Name, yeah, Mitt Romney's name came up as well, but of course, the Freedom Caucus really thinks he's a rhino, so that's not going to work.
Another helpful voice as a footnote in this discussion about the next Speaker of the House, helpful in quotation marks, perhaps, Harry Reid, Senate Democratic leader.
Yes.
He said, quote, that Paul Ryan would be a reasonable Speaker of the House of Representatives, and Reid called himself a Paul Ryan fan, even though he disagrees with him most of the time. So leaning over to try to give a kiss of death, I guess. Is that right, Stefan?
Yes, absolutely. When I heard that, I thought, you know, this is really Machiavellian politics. You know, you go over and you give the kiss of death to the guy that you want to undermine your opponents. And for Ryan, you know, having Harry Reid, who is the devil incarnate for Republicans, say that is really, really horrible. And you know, we can make fun of it, and it's extremely interesting to see. But, you know, really, it's a troubling kind of development for the country to be frozen up like that. Foreign leaders are laughing at the U.S. ISIS and others think that the United States is paralyzed because these things are reported there. And we've got several things coming up, including the debt ceiling, including a transportation bill and some other things that are critical and have to be done. And I don't know how they're going to do that unless they can get their house in order.
Stephen Schmidt with us of Iowa State University, where he's professor of political science. Donna Hoffman, our other analyst for this week, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Join our discussion. Is there something you see differently than our analysts this week? Do you have a question for them? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave a question or comment. Let's other political news we absolutely have to get to this week. Hillary Clinton heads into tomorrow's congressional hearing on the 2012 Benghazi attacks. The attacks resulted in the deaths of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Chris Stevens. Clinton testified before Congress, we have to remember, about this incident back in 2013. Now, Republicans on the Benghazi panel say they just want answers to questions and not to score political points. Other Republicans, however, most notably the number two House Republican, Kevin McCarthy, made some public comments speculating about how the panel's work affected Clinton's poll numbers. And for her part, Clinton has maintained that she had already answered questions back in 2013 about Benghazi and that the panel has become a partisan arm of the Republican Party. Donna Hoffman, let me go to you first. What will you be listening for in tomorrow's testimony?
Well, Hillary Clinton is a fairly skilled person to testify before Congress. She's done it a number of times. And as you mentioned, she's done it even on this issue before. The last time was when she kind of had the soundbite where she raised her voice, was a little angry. And so I will be looking for her demeanor in front of the committee to see how the committee Republicans in particular interact with her. And if they do try to stick to the issue of security and not make it personal, which I think they will take some pains to do that, given the discussions that have come out about why that committee exists. Democrats on the panel will be looking to undermine the things that the Republicans are looking for. And so I think the dynamics there between the congressional Republicans, the Democrats, and Hillary Clinton are what you want to watch in terms of how she handles herself, how the Republicans position themselves, and how the Democrats on the committee push back.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schmidt, can you help us understand the key questions that this investigation, this panel, is looking to answer still after, 13-plus months?
I think the key question is, what else can we do to destroy Hillary Clinton's candidacy for the White House? I mean, frankly.
Okay, so you see this as purely a political exercise.
There have been a whole number of reports that say, look, you know, this was one of many terrible disturbances, terrorist attacks that take place all over the world. There isn't really any way that there could have been a lot of new resources poured into Benghazi, which wasn't even the embassy. It wasn't even a consulate, frankly. It was a CIA safe house. And you know, with the budget cuts and so on, the State Department has a very limited amount of money to spend on security. And there are places, I mean, you talk about Afghanistan, you talk about Iraq, you talk about other countries where there are constant threats on American diplomats. And I think it is highly unrealistic to say that there should have been a clear response by the White House to somehow beef up security in Benghazi, which is a nothing place. I mean, Benghazi was not a critical place on anyone's map in terms of American diplomatic posts. And so, you know, they can continue to press forward and say that there were these emails from the ambassador requesting security and so on. All Hillary Clinton has to say is, you guys slashed the budget. We would have loved to strengthen all of our embassy security, but we just didn't have the budget to do it. And I think, you know, where else are they going to go with that?
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's a smoking gun, unless there's something we really, really don't know about. And the chair of the committee has darkly hinted that there are these new emails and, boy, they're really going to show something. And that may be, but I can't imagine what that would be.
Donna Hoffman, when you put this in the scales, on the one scale is substance in terms of the investigation, on the other scale is politics. Which side is heavier for you? I guess we know from Stefan that politics is vastly heavier here. What do you see?
Yeah, it's mostly politics. And, you know, we need to point out that this is the eighth congressional committee that has looked at this. and they have not found that quote-unquote smoking gun. Now, like Stefan said, there could still be one out there. There, you know, potentially are emails still hanging around, apparently. But it's been looked at. The issue's been looked at. Hillary Clinton has, you know, taken responsibility for it. So, yes, at this point, investigations have been done and have been done. And so I think it does mostly exist for political reasons, as we've had some significant Republicans, you know, basically speak truth to that issue recently. And that's why I think it'll be very interesting to watch the dynamics between the,
right.
the three
and these,
parties.
These latest utterances by GOP people commenting on the political nature of this changes the testimony. We are focusing on the Republicans in this panel, right? And they will have to really watch themselves to not increase the perception that this is a political exercise.
Right. They will want to make sure that they're sticking to, you know, investigatory issues and not political issues. And that may prove to be rather difficult. The Democrats certainly will keep pointing out why it is and how it is political.
Yeah, and the two things are the same, actually, investigative, political, you know, tweedledee, tweedledum, because, you know, the whole point is Hillary Clinton was, as Secretary of State, was negligent. The one thing that does help her a great deal, I think, is on the email question, right? Because that's part of this investigation is, you know, why she had her own server and that there were all kinds of possible emails there that are incriminating. And the hack of the head of the CIA and the head of Homeland Security yesterday is such an interesting development because it demonstrates that there is no such thing as safe and secure servers on anything and that everybody is negligent in the security of their emails. I mean, how could the head of the CIA have an AOL account? Nobody has AOL accounts anymore. You know, AOL is the weakest email system in terms of security, and the head of the CIA had it, and he had all kinds of documents in there that have been released with social security numbers and so on of people who are connected to the CIA. So it waters down that ominous notion that Hillary Clinton was really, really negligent, because obviously there is this incredible insecurity all over the place.
And I would point out that the committee chair also leaked a name he wasn't supposed to leak in an email, I believe it was, too.
That's right.
It didn't get redacted.
You know, so,
yeah.
I mean, it does. It kind of, right. You know, the technical issues here are, you know, things that we've been grappling with as a society as they've moved forward very quickly. And we haven't done a very good job in safeguarding those kinds of things at many different levels.
Okay. Just a minute or two before we go to break, but let's squeeze this in. Implications of a political landslide to our north. Canada's Prime Minister designate Justin Trudeau, who looks like he could be at one of our public universities, not as a professor, but as a student. He's a very young-looking guy. Came from behind to trounce his conservative rivals. Trudeau, campaigning on a promise of change, toppled Stephen Harper's Conservatives on Monday. Stefan Schmidt, any implications for U.S. politics?
Well, it was very interesting. My friend Arnie Arneson from New Hampshire yesterday lectured to my class here. She's visiting in Iowa. And she said she read some statements about, health insurance and, you know, higher education tuition breaks and other things. And she said, "Who said that?" And the students thought it was Bernie Sanders. And she said, "Nope, it was the new Prime Minister of Canada." And so, you know, the interesting thing is that behind him, when he accepted, the victory, was the largest sign I've ever seen that said Liberal, right? Because it's the Liberal Party. So there are things happening there that are very interesting. The Conservative really ran out the clock, and there were a lot of things that weren't working very well. And so there was a swing to the tide of a Liberal. But on the other hand, let me put it this way. Nobody in the U.S. cares about Canada. When I tried to tell people how exciting this was, they kind of looked at me like I was crazy.
Okay.
I actually had a student ask about it yesterday.
Wow.
So.
A Canadian student, probably.
No, actually not.
Okay. Go Panthers then, huh?
That's right.
Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, our political analyst this week. When we come back, we'll, of course, have Donna and Stefan still with us as we pick through politics of recent days. But we'll also hear from John Dillon of Vermont Public Radio. He'll give us a long view of Bernie Sanders. He's covered Sanders for more than 25 years. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. One day a week, we like to get analysis of the latest on the political landscape. And joining us this hour to do that, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. But before we go back to them for more analysis, the improbable rise of Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders. a candidate for president whose policy platforms are singularly focused on income inequality and curbing corporate power. This is how Sanders introduced himself in last week's Democratic debate.
The middle class of this country for the last 40 years has been disappearing. Millions of Americans are working longer hours for low wages, and yet almost all of the new income and wealth being created is going to the top 1%. As a result of this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision, our campaign finance system is corrupt and is undermining American democracy. Millionaires and billionaires are pouring unbelievable sums of money into the political process in order to fund super PACs and to elect candidates who represent their interests, not the interests of working people.
Bernie Sanders last week. You probably know Sanders as a U.S. Senator from Vermont. He's served in that position since 2007. Something, though, you might not know, he's the longest-serving independent in U.S. congressional history. Sanders caucuses with the Democratic Party. He has been the ranking minority member on the Senate Budget Committee since January of 2015. Joining us with more insights from Sanders' home state, John Dillon, news director of Vermont Public Radio. He's covered Sanders for more than 25 years. Hello, John.
Good afternoon.
So give us a longer view than what we've had here in Iowa or across most of the nation. What do people need to know about his origins to understand him as a candidate today?
Well, you mentioned his singular focus on income inequality, and I guess that, to me, is what has defined Bernie Sanders for as long as I've covered him, even when he was running as a third-party candidate for U.S. senator and governor in the state of Vermont back in the 70s. He talked about these issues that he's talking about today. When we were getting ready to cover, we at VPR, his presidential campaign, we went back into the archives. One of the reporters here has followed him as a radio journalist for years. And we had tape going back, I believe, it was his second year after he won as Burlington mayor. So it was 1982. And I swear, you could listen to those interviews and think it was yesterday in Iowa.
Really?
He has sounded the same themes for that long.
And he's always called himself a Democratic Socialist?
He has, but he's run as an independent, which I think is important to remember. He's not run as a member of the Socialist Workers' Party or anything like that. He's always run as an independent, except when he was affiliated with what was called the Liberty Union Party in Vermont back early to mid-70s, and that was a party that was largely formed in opposition to the Vietnam War, and it tried to field a number of statewide candidates, never garnered more than 6 or 7% of the vote, and Sanders was in the low single digits when he ran under the Liberty Union banner. It wasn't until 1981, as an independent, he won his first office, and that was as mayor of Burlington, Vermont's mm-hmm. largest city.
What would you say are his biggest influences that shape who he is today as a politician?
I think his childhood in Brooklyn, he and his brother Larry, his older brother Larry, grew up lower middle income class family, working class neighborhood in Flatbush. His mother died shortly after he graduated from high school. She was 46, so she died quite young. They struggled financially. He talks about that. His friends talk about him talking about that. They were not poor, but it was a rent-controlled apartment, and he's described parental or family arguments over money, his mother always looking to pinch pennies, making things, stretching things. His father was a paint salesman who came over, who was an emigre from Poland. His family had been wiped out in the Holocaust, and that was another factor I think that really influenced Bernie Sanders was the fact that, and he talks about this, that an election in Germany led to a regime that annihilated a whole people in Europe, or tried to. So he believes, and he mentions this quite often, that campaigns do have consequences, and I think that sort of focused his mind on both growing up the way he did and his identity as someone, the son of a Holocaust whose family was affected by the Holocaust. I think both of those things really influenced him. And then he went to the University of Chicago, which at the time in the late 60s was sort of mid to late 60s, very politically aware, sort of left-leaning. He became involved in racial equality issues there as a student protester.
Mm-hmm. How do his politics on the left side of the spectrum fit into the political culture of Vermont as a whole?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, I've seen lawn signs on people's lawns. Bernie Sanders and a Republican candidate for governor. Recently we had
together in the
Jim
same
Douglas
lawn.
On the same lawn. He appeals a lot to the sort of the independent streak of Vermonters. People, you know, vote for him to go to D.C. and raise hell. I've heard that more than once. He's really identified with rural issues, which is amazing because he's obviously not from a rural state, although he's lived up here for a long time. He really advocated for Vermont's dairy farmers early on in his political career, and has many contacts in the more rural parts of the state. The thing that you have to remember about Vermont, and it's probably true with Iowa, is that it's a very retail politics state where you practically meet every candidate a couple of times a campaign season. Mm-hmm. It's that small. And Sanders is very he's untiring in his campaign, and he's in campaigning, and he's met a lot of people throughout the state, and they like what he does. He shows up in parades, and they say, "Give him hell, Bernie, when you get down there."
Wow!
And I think that sort of transcends his left-leaning positions.
How surprised are Vermonters about the surge of national support for Sanders? Did they perhaps think before this thing caught fire that he was a phenomenon that was for Vermonters?
I think people are surprised. Speaking for myself, I thought he'd strike a nerve, that his position that, you know, has been consistent for a quarter of a century on income inequality, on the growing wealth gap, would resonate. But I think what happened is that the issue caught up with him in that regard. You know, that following the Great Recession in 2008 and sort of wage stagnation and the whole situation with jobs going overseas, everything he's been talking about for years have become more part of people's everyday consciousness. They feel it more too. You know, they're maybe on fixed incomes, they're struggling. So everything that Bernie Sanders has talked about for his entire political career is now being felt by perhaps more of a majority of the population. And he's, you know, he can rightly claim to own that issue. Mm-hmm. And so that accounts for some of it. But I think Vermonters are surprised. We thought, you know, maybe he was just a Vermont phenomenon.
Thank you so much. Valuable insights from John Dillon, a long view of Bernie Sanders. John Dillon, news director of Vermont Public Radio. He's covered Sanders for more than 25 years. Thank you so much for this conversation, John.
You're very welcome.
And if you want to dig deeper into the Bernie Sanders story, check out an excellent radio documentary produced by Vermont Public Radio called Becoming Bernie, His Rise and His Record. We have a link to it on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Go to iowapublicradio.org to listen to that Vermont Public Radio documentary, Becoming Bernie. Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. Donna Hoffman still with us from the University of Northern Iowa. Glad to have them this week as our political analysts. Before we move on to other current politics, let me get both of your reactions to that. Donna Hoffman, your thoughts on the rise of Bernie Sanders after hearing some more background?
Well, I mean, I think that's pretty consistent with some of the things that, you know, have been leaking out about him, that, you know, Bernie is basically Bernie. And I was struck by, you know, your guest's comments on surprising Vermonters about his rise. But I think Bernie Sanders has been surprised about his rise.
He's admitted it, yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's very interesting to watch him as a political phenomenon come outside, do retail politics in Iowa and other places, and see how he responds to crowds and see how crowds respond to him, because it's very interesting.
Right. And to hear that, if you go back to tape of him being interviewed in the early 80s, you could think it was yesterday. So this is the remark that the supporters or some segment of our population has caught up to his views that he's held for a long time. Stefan, your thoughts?
Well, you know, that happens. I mean, times change, and the new generation of Americans is young people understand the importance of government in many parts of their lives, and I think it resonates. You know, he is a phenomenon because nobody can figure out why young people are volunteering to write code and create apps and so on for him free of charge, and why they come to his rallies in massive numbers, 26,000, I think, or something like that in L.A. Nobody can figure that out. And it's because he is this genuine person. I think there is a certain amount of respect for someone older like that. There's a fascination, maybe nostalgia with someone, you know, who has those particular firm moral values and economic values and doesn't change them, doesn't take money from political action committees. And people write him small checks, and it's lots of people who are writing those. So there is something very kind of mystical about him, really, which I haven't figured out yet.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch over to the GOP column in the presidential race to cover at least a couple things that have been happening in the last few days. We had sort of a tit-for-tat happening. Donald Trump, the leader in the polls, provoking a tit-for-tat with Jeb Bush, who is, I believe, in the high single digits, according to most polls. Starting Friday of last week, Trump said that Jeb Bush's brother, of course, George W. Bush, former president, must share some of the blame for the attacks that Trump made, the attacks that happened on 9/11. Trump made these comments in an interview with Fox Business's Stuart Varney.
You know, he gave a speech at one point, and he also, during the debates, he said the country was safe under my brother. And I said, just very nicely, under a very little program, I said, well, wait a minute, it wasn't safe because the World Trade Center fell down under your brother's regime. So the world wasn't safe. The country wasn't safe. We had the biggest catastrophe and the greatest catastrophe we've ever had in history under your brother's reign. So, you know, he could have said maybe safe since. But, of course, then we went into the war in Iraq, and that was a disaster, complete disaster, caused thousands of lives and everything else. But the fact is, Stuart, he said the country was safe. Well, the country wasn't safe because the World Trade Center had just fallen down.
Of course, Jeb Bush firing back. He gave this response when asked, if your brother and his – this is by a CNN anchor – if your brother and his administration bear no responsibility at all for 9/11, how do you then make that jump that President Obama and Secretary Clinton are responsible for what happened in Benghazi?
Well, it's the question on Benghazi, which is hopefully will now finally get the truth to, is – Was the place secure? They had a responsibility in the Department of State to have proper security. There were calls for security. It looks like they didn't get it. And how was the response in the aftermath of the attack? Was there a chance that these four American lives could have been saved? That's what the investigation is about. It's not a political issue. It's not about the broad policy issue. Is were we doing the job of protecting our embassies and our consulates? And during the period, those hours after the attack started, could they have been saved?
Okay, Donna Hoffman and Stefan Schmidt, let's get your views on this back and forth here. Just a couple of clips from the back and forth. There are other installments that happened within the last few days. So Donna Hoffman, your thoughts on this move by Donald Trump to attack a cornerstone of Republican thought on 9/11 that George W. Bush kept us safe?
I mean, I think it's consistent with Trump in that, you know, you never know what's going to come out of his mouth in many respects. But, you know, it is the case that the Bush administration was more focused on traditional threats to the United States, state sponsors of terrorism. They weren't so focused on non-state actors until 9/11 happened. And, you know, we saw a shift. So, I mean, history will look back at the event, and certainly it happened on George W. Bush's watch. Does he bear sole responsibility for that? I don't think so. But there was a shift in terms of how global politics started to work, and terrorism being something that wasn't new, but coming from now non-state actors that gained real prominence because they were able to attack the United States on 9/11. And so history will look back on that event, and it'll be colored by, and it certainly is now, by where one sits partisanly. And that's going to color history, I think, as well, in terms of how we look back at that particular event and whether there's ever a time in which we say it was one particular person's fault, which is, you know, not something that really is ever going to probably pass the smell test.
Okay, Stefan Schmidt, your view on this correction of history by Donald Trump.
It has nothing to do with whether Bush was at fault. It was his administration that had been sworn in, had been in power for 8 months. There were all kinds of intelligence that were fed to them, including that very disturbing request from an FBI agent in Phoenix, I think, saying that you should immediately check, companies that train pilots to see what's going on there. I mean, that was in an FBI urgent request that was sent to the White House.
Well, you had Richard Clark sending a memo, right, that al-Qaeda,
Bin Laden's name was also mentioned. And so, of course, there were a thousand things that were coming in, and when an administration is new, there's all kinds of chaos. But, after all, it is on your watch. The buck stops here. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's using, the baseball bat, and he seems to love to really use it on Jeb Bush, because Jeb Bush has a very thin skull and freaks out and responds in ways that then people make fun of. I feel very sorry for Jeb Bush, because Jeb Bush is not up to competing with Donald Trump. You know, the others might be better at it, but he certainly, it seems to just get right under his skin.
In his defense, Jeb Bush said in this tit for tat also, quote, across the spectrum of foreign policy, Mr. Trump talks about things as though he's still on The Apprentice. And I know you picked that up in some reading you pointed out to me,
yeah.
Stefan Schmidt.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Well, there is a fabulous article in, I think it's this week. Yeah, it's this week's Bloomberg Business Week, which I get. In which they point out that in Iowa, for example, one of his vice chairs was one of the finalists on The Apprentice. She's from Iowa. And what she's doing is using apprentice-like contests to recruit people, have them go into malls, get signatures, and then gives them prizes. And there is a poll that shows that people who are followers of the program, The Apprentice, and love the show are a majority of the people who are saying that they're going to support him and vote for him. And so there is this very interesting sudden overwash between popular culture and politics. And Donald Trump is the only person who has that brand with him. Nobody else can attract the followers of The Apprentice, because they were not, maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger will in the future, but that's a fascinating thing. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is a showman, and he is completely outfoxed and outwitted the Republican Party, which is going crazy with his poll numbers, and the other candidates who compared to Trump are just not very interesting. They're not very much fun, frankly. Mm-hmm. And he is a lot of fun, even though it's a little frightening.
Mm-hmm. Donald Trump, to finish up our program, Donald Trump has been on top of the Republican presidential field for more than 3 months now. And if we think back, and if we are honest with ourselves, I don't want to quote anybody here. We've had a lot of analysts on this show, but I have to say, across the board, when he first announced his candidacy, dismissed by everyone, a joke candidate. We were told then this is only a temporary phenomenon, like Michelle Bachmann. Today, polls showing nearly a third of Republican voters pick Trump as their candidate, followed by 22% who choose Ben Carson. Donna Hoffman, is it time to concede that Trump has the best shot to win the GOP nomination, that he's not a temporary thing, that that he is the best positioned one here?
No.
No.
I still do not think he will get the Republican nomination. He is proving very fascinating. That is true. And Stefan pointed out this merging of popular culture and politics here. But let's just take the case of Iowa. When Trump was in Waterloo recently at the Electric Park Ballroom, Tripp Gabriel, reporter for The New York Times, walked among the crowd and said, and started asking people, have you ever been to a Republican caucus before? And he found very few people in that crowd who had been to who had caucused. And the challenge for Trump in the state has always been. He's exciting people, those people who watch The Apprentice, who probably have not been politically active. Caucuses are a unique thing. They're meetings. It takes some time commitment. And will his campaign actually be able to turn out those supporters in an Iowa caucus? I remain skeptical that he will be able to do that.
I did read the article.
And I still think
these people were saying, "I've never participated in politics. This is incredible. I am so excited. I think I'm going to go to the caucuses this year." And the campaign is recording names, emails, and so on, and they have a very sophisticated effort to try to essentially create a good database, and I think they'll follow up with it.
Okay,
I'm not convinced they will follow up with it. The Trump bus that went around with Ragbrite got sold, and now it's a piece of performance art.
It was a crummy bus. It was a cheap bus, as Trump would say.
Stephen Schmidt,
it's a more important.
We have less than
bus.
A minute left, Donna. You've had your say. Now I'm going to put Stephen's feet to the fire. Are you going to concede that Trump will likely be the GOP nominee?
I think he can. I think he can be. Because there are so many others who are, frankly, not getting any traction, but they're staying in. And so the people who support them continue to cling to the hope that Bobby Jindal is going to actually make it to the top. And if that happens, then Trump is going to have proportionately more people supporting him. And I think he will organize. I think he will turn out people.
Okay. Fascinating, this political season. And it's fascinating to talk to our analysts this week, Stephen Schmidt and Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Stephen is Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Stephen, Donna, what a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. In Ames, we had help from Jason Burns. In Cedar Falls, help from Tony Daner. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can write us our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.